This program is brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. We hope you enjoy the program. Hello, and welcome to the Anchoring Truths podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Snedeker. We're doing something a little different for this week's episode. Last week, the James Wilson Institute co-sponsored a conference celebrating the intellectual contributions of our new co-director, Professor Jerry Bradley, after nearly four decades in the Legal Academy. As part of that conference, several scholars delivered public remarks praising Professor Bradley's work. We could think of nothing better than to share with you some of those remarks from our founder and now co-director, Hadley Arkus. We think Professor Arkus's remarks demonstrate just why we at the James Wilson Institute like to say that, for the Institute, the best is yet to come. We hope you enjoy.
Well, we come to the conclusion of our second of our 3 days celebrating Professor Gerard Bradley as he gets ready to retire from law teaching at University of Notre Dame, and we have between us and our evening meal, what I'm sure is going to be a very colorful celebration of Jerry and his work, having seen Dr. Hadley Arkus in action many times. I first saw Hadley in action more than two decades ago. He would have no idea that I actually saw him on this occasion, because at that time he had no idea who I was. I was practicing law in Boston, and my wife, Katie, was studying at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where she was pursuing her graduate studies. A year earlier, as law clerk to the late, great Benjamin Kaplan, senior status for the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, then sitting on the Massachusetts Appeals Court, I had witnessed firsthand oral arguments in the case Goodrich versus Department of Public Health at the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. And I had been appalled at the professional malpractice of the assistant Massachusetts Attorney General who had been sent to argue the case. In particular, her express disavowal during oral arguments of what was obviously the strongest argument in favor of Massachusetts law. Massachusetts, of course, defined in law as marriage had always been defined in our immemorial and universal law as the union of a man and a woman. And it seemed pretty apparent, not only to me, but also to the justices, that the best argument in her favor was to connect marriage to the well-being of children. She said she was not going to pursue that line of argumentation. And this seemed to me a fairly obvious exercise in legal malpractice. Now, at the time, I had not given much thought to the underlying substantive question, what marriage is in fact. But I cared deeply about the rule of law, and this display of lawlessness by the Assistant Massachusetts Attorney General suggested to me that this was no ordinary constitutional dispute, and that perhaps what was happening in Goodrich was in fact radically incompatible with maintaining the rule of law. This began my, you might say, intellectual journey into the substantive questions we've been discussing over the last couple of days. So months later, I eagerly joined Katie at Harvard one evening when we saw advertised that Professor Arkus was coming to debate the question that the Massachusetts court had made unavoidable by this point. Hadley did not disappoint. He argued the merits of an increasingly unpopular and increasingly important opinion with grace and humor and clarity. And unfortunately, his interlocutors did disappoint. It was clear that their minds were closed on all of the important questions and that they had nothing interesting or persuasive to say in answer to the questions that Hadley raised, but were instead dogmatically committed to the ad hominem. They seemed to have a subrational need to mischaracterize Hadley's arguments and to portray him as some kind of bigot. I found their reaction equally as instructive as I found Hadley's argument. In response to one particularly egregious distortion of the position he had been defending, Hadley stated calmly and succinctly, "I do not believe you have had the pleasure of understanding me." Those of you who know Hadley recognize this as a distinctly Hadley locution. That his interlocutors desired such pleasure, of course, he plainly implied. That they had no such desire, in fact, was equally plain. But what I learned that evening from Hadley was that self-evident truths are capable of defending themselves, if only we will stand them up on the front line and give them a fighting chance. In the decades since then, no one's more openly and lucidly articulated the first practical principles that make sense of our deepest constitutional commitments, without recognition of which constitutional law devolves into politics by other means. The most recent of his many books is Mere Natural Law, Originalism and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution. His many scholarly works, of course, include books with Princeton University Press, Cambridge University Press, and Regnery Gateway. He's an emeritus professor at Amherst College, and where he previously served as the Edward Nade Professor of Jurisprudence. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Illinois and a PhD from the University of Chicago, and is the founding director of the James Wilson Institute, one of our co-sponsors, where our beloved Professor Bradley will be joining him in a matter of weeks. Hadley.
Thanks for that sweet introduction, but that line I was simply quoting from Mr. Benedict, Pride and Prejudice, where he said, "Oh my dear, you don't have the pleasure of understanding me." Right? But it feels like I'm lecturing to the survivors. I usually say, when I get an introduction like that, I usually get up and say, "Look, I just came in here to read the meter," and they ask me to offer a few remarks while I'm here. Okay. Dearly beloved, a fast drift usually marks a distinguished academic career coming to a dignified culmination, looking back on work essentially completed. But in this case, Jerry's work has been taking on a new momentum, I think, with even more writing, ever sharper, ever more penetrating. We're looking back now on a remarkable body of work that's been animated by a central, enduring moral concern. He's not lost himself in refinements of the Administrative Procedures Act. He's dealt persistently with the gravest issues that have vexed our politics and thrown our judges into philosophic confusion. At the center, of course, have been those issues of abortion and assisted suicide and freedom of religion. But as the culture deepened, there was a need to defend what has been clumsily called traditional marriage, and called it even by conservatives. It's taken Jerry really to offer the almost alone voice among conservatives in jurisprudence to insist that it's not traditional marriage. It's but what marriage truly is. It's what Father Shaw, James Shaw, used to call the what is question. What is a table? What is a human being? What is a real marriage? A question of really of what is this distinct form of marriage among human beings. And then the culture took an even more implausible turn when you find people with medical degrees backed by deep wealth, ready to take seriously the notion that people may be born into the wrong bodies. Well, rather than going quietly off into the sunset, Jerry is simply moving his teaching into a different venue. He is now joining me as co-director of the James Wilson Institute. So he's a luminary figure, a central figure in a strengthening project of natural law with colleagues and students who are not only supportive but reverential, and with judges now coming over to our side. I must say, I feel awkward stating, I've got Edith in the audience, I shouldn't be up here. But it's going to be ever harder for Jerry to say I'm just a poor kid who grew up in New York, so I'm a devotee of the honeymooners, you know. Yeah, but also, he did not go from the top of his class at Cornell to clerking for a famous judge. He rather threw himself into the gritty work of the law, working as a prosecutor in Manhattan in the office of that famous member of the Amherst class of 1942, Robert Morgenthau. That's Amherst 42. Now, in the style of This Is Your Life, I'd like to go back to an episode where Jerry, now a professor of law, drew on that experience as a prosecutor when testifying in Congress on a matter that touched the very ground of just who are those rights-bearing beings who are protected under the Constitution. I think it was a riveting moment, and I can say that with assurance because I was there and I saw it. And so I'll take us back now 25 years ago to 1999 when Lindsey Graham, Lindsey was in the House from South Carolina, he brought forth the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. Jerry and I were testifying before the subcommittee of the Constitution of the House, and we're joined there by Michael Lenz, whose pregnant wife, Carrie, died in the awful bombing at the Federal Murrow Building in Oklahoma in 1995. And what he wanted is that the law should recognize that he had lost two people that day. He lost Carrie and his son, Michael. But the federal law, criminal law, offered no recognition for the killing of that unborn child. The man described as Airman Robbins, living on a military base in Ohio in 1988, savagely built beat his pregnant wife until he ruptured her uterus and the child in the womb died. Robbins was court-martialed, ordered confined for 8 years, but as part of the plea deal, the charge of murder was dropped. And after all, federal law had not supplied a ground for the murder of the unborn child. Mr. Lenz was convinced that he'd lost two people dear to him, and that brute fact was curiously at issue. Representative Zoe Lofgren of California was fiercely opposed to that bill, as she was fiercely opposed to the Lucy and Connor bill that Jerry mentioned earlier. Mark Peterson killing his pregnant wife, Lucy, along with son Connor, she was carrying. But Zoe Lofgren insisted that the sole wrong knowable to the law, he was Peterson's assault on his wife. For anyone with eyes to see, it was evident that two bodies had washed ashore that day. But for Zoe Lofgren, the ideological screen had come down, and that barred her from seeing what anyone with eyes to see could see washing on shore. And so my old nemesis, Jerry Nadler, went to the heart of the matters instantly when he said that this Unborn Victims of Violence Act is an attempt to undermine Roe versus Wade and to thwart a woman's right to safe and legal abortion. And so it was. But only touching the root point that this offspring in the womb was nothing less than a human being at any stage of its growth. But that was all. Lindsey Graham was careful to have his bill say that the prosecutions would not be permitted for conduct relating to an abortion for which the consent of the pregnant woman had been obtained. So all we'd be doing is kind of reenacting the awkward inconsistency that we've been living with for many years, that a child in the womb could inherit property or have standing against a negligent driver, but no standing against the abortionist about to dismember or poison him. I pointed out in my own testimony that the drafters of the bill were careful to keep the measure within the bounds recognized so far for the reach of federal authority. But those bounds had been altered notably within our own lifetimes. Remember, when John F. Kennedy was shot in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald would have been prosecuted for murder under the laws of Texas, right? Remember? The killing of the President of the United States was not then a federal crime. It was a regime-altering case when those three civil rights workers were murdered brutally in Mississippi in the early 60s. And by 1966, the court was no longer trying to work through the maze of federalism to see if the FBI could reach that case. They're on the scene right away. Professor Bradley would make the point strongly that the bill did not extend the reach of Congress. He said, no conduct which is presently free of federal regulation will in the future be regulated if that act becomes a law. No conduct which is lawful here is to be unlawful. But then he went on to justify the legal move to protect the unborn child with that careful reading of cases that had become one of his marks. So he acknowledged the serious argument on the other side that this move to declare that the unborn are persons, or at least the unborn are human beings with a right to life, isn't that declaration that inconsistent with Roe? And at this point, he engaged in the kind of close reasoning that some of us have drawn from Lincoln in response to the decision in Dred Scott. So Jerry conceded that the opponents of the bill would be quite right, that the bill was at odds with Roe, if the Supreme Court in Roe, or in another case, held that the unborn are not persons, or at least human beings with a right to life. But Jerry observed, bringing some news, that the court has never so held. He said the Roe court said expressly that it need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. The court said in Roe that the judiciary is not in a position to speculate as to an answer to that question. All that the court held in Roe was that Texas could not override the rights of the pregnant woman by adopting an answer to the question of life when life begins. The Roe court did say that the unborn are not persons in the whole sense, but read in context, that clearly means simply that Texas could not adopt a view of the person of the unborn which conflicted with the liberty rights of the pregnant woman. So, he says, it is consistent with Roe to say the following. As to the rest of the world, that is to all persons, all individuals other than the pregnant woman and those cooperating with her, a legislature is entitled to recognize the unborn as a person with a right to life. Again, as to the rest of the world, it is consistent with Roe to take this view of the act. But of course, it was the very purpose of the law to plant that premise, which had to be at odds with the premises of Roe versus Wade. But Jerry was taking this moment to offer a lesson about the structure of the Constitution, because recalling Lincoln, that the political branches would respect the judgment of the court in regard to those litigants, but they'd be free to act upon a different principle coming under their hands if they had not been persuaded. I used that argument once before the Judiciary Committee, and Jerry Nadler tried to twit me and said, Professor, yeah, we should try revising some other case. We ought to try revising that case called Bush versus Gore. And I said, Congressman, you should really try it just to get practice. But remember, you still have to respect the outcome of the case in regard to those two litigants. Now, there was earnest testimony that day from Ms. Pamela Stewart, a graduate of Mount Holyoke, a former federal prosecutor, claimed to bring in that real-world perspective that will face a federal prosecutor. And from that perspective, she said, this bill will be a nightmare to enforce. Was it clear that a woman was pregnant? Did the assailant know that and still intentionally carry out the assault? But Professor Bradley could bring in his own real-world perspective of a prosecutor, working for a longer time in the trenches, dealing with gritty crimes in Manhattan, and not exactly what Ms. Stewart was doing in litigating for the Federal Trade Commission. And so Jerry pointed out without notable strain that there are really no puzzles here that should tax the wit of a prosecutor, let her keep her up at night with nightmares. And the gentle implication was that if she's really having trouble with this one, she's probably in the wrong line of work. He pointed out that under the statute, an offender is strictly liable for the harm caused to the unborn child. If this reading is correct, no problem of proving either intent or knowledge should arise. He appeared before many juries, and so he thought the jurors will follow the instructions of the court. And if the statute is clear, so will be the instructions, and so, he said, will be the juror's duty. Right? Or as Henry James would put it, Ms. Stewart was making herself the victim of perplexities from which a single spark of direct perception could have saved her. Direct perception. Was it a matter of looking directly at what was there before our eyes, or was it a need to look past the distractions to the center or the nature of the thing, even if it wasn't immediately evident to sight? So as Professor Bradley was drawn into the argument over marriage, he found himself among his friends, allies, who became curiously confused about the defense of marriage as they sought to explain what may make marriage, as we've known it, the legal union of one man and one woman, make what makes that notion of marriage more desirable or better than same-sex marriage. There was a strong tendency at work to drift away from that question of what marriage really is. Is it a relation offering enduring emotional support and love unalloyed? Is it what Justice Kennedy suggested when he said it was the remedy for loneliness, the presence of someone who is there when one calls out in the night? Justin said that he knew many happily married couples, didn't know a single one who were compatible. men and women are not compatible. A number of my students used to insist that erotic attraction is wholly subjective. They're wholly subjective. I said, okay, let's try it this way. I married her for her exquisite blondness and complexion. She went perfectly with the drapes of my apartment. But now I'm doing the place all over in Art Deco, and she just no longer fits. That story used to elicit a laugh. Though not as much anymore. And as ever, the laugh is the key to an understanding that people cannot yet quite express. What it reveals is a state of mind that trivializes marriage. Looks may alter with age, but we're drawn rather to a love founded on a sense of what is deeply admirable about the wife or husband, something of moral significance that will not erode with looks and age. Age has not impaired her infinite appeal to Cleopatra. So we're drawn in the same way to what is in principle good about marriage itself. But many of the leading arguments, as Jerry pointed out, drew us away from that question. The evidence has become quite strong that children are apt to do far better in life if they're raised by two married parents, a mother and a father. But of course, that's a generalization. And with any generalization, it's not necessarily the case. There are many dysfunctional families containing fathers and mothers. And in contrast, many aunts and uncles and same-sex couples have proved to be quite able in the nurturing function of parenting. And so nothing in that generalization provides any ground of principle for denying a marriage license to this particular gay or lesbian couple. A point I think I was making back in Cambridge 20 years ago, Adam. Any generalization really gives us a speculation or probability statement of what's likely to happen. It cannot say what is right or wrong with marriage as an institution, even if the parents turn out to be bumbling failures in raising children. But it was actually the rejection of such probabilistic reasoning that led to one of the signal mistakes made by conservatives as well as liberals in trying to understand this case for marriage. The argument was sounded in one of its most decisive moments when the Supreme Court of Massachusetts in the Goodrich case struck down the laws that confined marriage to two people of the opposite sex. The court declared that the law may not privilege procreation as the ground that explains and justifies marriage. But of course, not all couples are able to beget. And as the court pointed out, people are permitted to marry even when they're past the age of begetting. Justice Scalia will later make that same argument to the embarrassment of conservative jurisprudence, as Jerry will later point out in a decisive way. But some of us found another revelation there. In the use of that argument by the majority in the Goodrich case, for we've been typically hearing in all these arguments for sexual liberation and gay rights that there were no firm moral truths that justified the casting of adverse judgments in the law about the way that people lived out their sexual lives. But now we're told there was not only a ringing truth bearing on the moral rightness or wrongness of denying same-sex marriage, but it was a categorical truth. It was a proposition that answers to the question, is it necessarily true that? Is it necessarily true that all couples suited for marriage are capable of having offspring? Well, that argument did some critical work for them, but it was a source of a kind of jujitsu, for it cut against some of the critical argument offered in defense of same-sex marriage. And so the argument was made at the time of the Defense of Marriage Act that if we severed, back when we did the Defense of Marriage Act, if we severed marriage from a couple and the prospect of begetting, what was the rationale for confining a marriage to a couple? People could argue that their own loves were not confined to a coupling, that their loves were woven together in a cluster of three or more. And if that were the case, that ensemble could not be confined to people of the same sex. It would have to be available to ensembles of mixed sexes, which is to say we're back to polygamy. When we're doing the hearings on the Defense of Marriage Act, one person was asked, one of my person who's asked the question remarked that the people at home were not, we asked, on what ground would you bar polygamy? And there's one fellow from Idaho said, well, people back in Idaho were not much interested in polygamy. But of course, they're not much interested because the law for many years had barred polygamy. And if the law dropped the rejection of polygamy, was it really unthinkable that the interest might revive? And indeed, polygamy has amply revived now in the Southwest, along with the polyamorous ensembles. And Teresa tells me that now Minnesota is making explicit recognition of throuples and threesomes, right? But the ripples radiated far beyond that. If procreation had nothing to do with the matter, why couldn't we have a father marrying his son or mother marrying his daughter? I said at one point, the judges in the Supreme Court of Massachusetts might not have been our very best, but it's hard to imagine that they would deny the need for consummation in ordinary marriage, but insist on its absolute necessity with the marriage of a father and then a son. It doesn't matter that these things may be rare, the marriage of a father and a son. The point is that there was no ground of principle for rejecting any of these things once it was held that sexual consummation was not necessary in defining marriage. The question was raised by some commentators then as to whether marriage could be detached from sex altogether, in which case one of my former students asked, well, why would not it be available to two sisters or two uncles taking care of an orphan nephew and likely to benefit from special provisions in the insurance for a family or joint tax returns? During the hearings on the Defense of Marriage Act, my old buddy, Congressman Barney Frank, offered that line that would echo again and again. How does it adversely affect anyone else's marriage that a gay or lesbian couple would be allowed to marry? And the answer, as Professor Bradley would point out, is that it affected everything. It affected almost everyone at every turn. It not only altered what counted as marriage, but it transformed the way people understood what they were doing, who they were, as they entered into something they were pleased now to call a marriage. In Tom Stoppard's matchless play, Jumpers, an investigating detective remarked to Professor Moore, Professor Moore, your wife, when she was on the stage, was a consummate actress. Yes, but regrettably, she retired from consummation at the same time she retired from the stage. And yes, no, it's not so easy to put consummation aside, for it leads to the question of what sex really is. Why is the understanding of marriage tied inescapable to that understanding of sex? And here is another place. People may concede unwittingly through the laugh what they would not concede if were put to them in the form of an explicit argument. And so people record the real sense of the homosexual life as they respond to Rodney Dangerfield's line, I was afraid, he said. I was afraid the first time I had sex. I was afraid because I was all alone. Well, the laugh marked the recognition that this really, two people in tandem replicated the masturbation in Prospect and the joke, it would still not be sex. When Cardinal Ratzinger was the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the congregation pointed out, there's not always been in Italy or Hungary, but as long as they're human beings, there must be men and women, males and females. That's the very meaning, the very telos, the purpose that defines real sex. And apart from all the many nice things said about couples offering mutual sustaining support and love, sex must be at the very core of the things and the logic and meaning of marriage. And as Professor Bradley pointed out, so many of these other good things may mark simply the instrumental values of marriage, rather than marking what is intrinsically good or intrinsically important or decisively definitive. Jerry Bradley, it says that the law to be coherent must shape its version of marriage around the truth of marriage. But like two sides of a concave line, conservative jurisprudence has mimicked the liberals in denying that main defining truth of marriage. And so Justice Scalia rather echoed the court in Massachusetts when he said that the encouragement of procreation could not supply the ground for denying marriage to a same-sex couple because the sterile and the elderly are allowed to marry. He put the matter even more baldly, of course, in Obergefell, where he said famously that the substance of the decision of marriage is not of immense personal importance to me. The law can recognize whatever sexual attachments and living arrangements it wishes. So it's not of special importance to me what the law says about marriage. It's the fact that who rules me? The fact that 320 million Americans are going to be ruled by a majority of 9 judges. What he held to was the right of the ruling majority in any place to reach a moral judgment on marriage along with everything else. In his version of realism, the rejection of same-sex marriage came down to the brute fact that the majority was expressing its disapproval of the homosexual life. For Scalia, this was simply a, quote, value judgment. He affirmed the authority of the ruling majority to shape the moral character of the community, whether in marriage or lewd entertainments or anything else, and yet notably, he withheld any confidence that there were any moral truths underlying those moral judgments. As a Catholic, he believed in moral truths, but he was dubious that reason can discern any moral truth that could command a consensus in the public and provide the ground then for an enforceable judgment of the law. He never bothered to send out ballots among his friends to see if he could establish a consensus on that single truth, that the test of moral truth must be that it commands a consensus. We never had a test of that point. Which is to say, he supplied no moral ground for his defense of marriage, in part because he didn't think that explaining the moral ground of the law was his job, but in part also because in his heart of hearts, he did not think that the law could supply one. And so he found himself awash in all the arguments about the extrinsic goods of marriage, whether couples could be deft at raising good children, putting them on the proper paths in life, rather than recognizing, as Jerry said, that marriage is intrinsically and not merely incidentally or instrumentally related to procreation. Okay, but then, what was that intrinsic importance that would be there even if no children arrived through begetting? The center of the thing, of course, was the one flesh union. The children were the magical embodiment of that one flesh union. They were the beings who combined the genes of both parents into one body. In a telling moment years ago, I saw my 5-year-old youngest son on a swing in Georgetown and suddenly saw in him the features of my mother's mother, who had died 6 years before he was born. He was the walking monument of a love between my grandparents that went back to the earlier years of the 20th century. But that one flesh union was marked in what has to be called the most natural coupling of bodies for the purpose of bringing forth that one flesh embodiment of the union. What was distinctive to male and females were the systems of reproductive organs that came together in a complementary way in the coupling. So Jerry caught the matter in this way. He said, just as an individual's different organs, heart, lungs, arteries, perform not as isolated parts, but in a coordinated unity to carry out a single biological function of the whole individual, so too in the coitus, the sexual organs of the male and those of the female function in a coordinated way to carry out a biological function of the couple as a unit in mating. Hence, coitus establishes a real biological union with respect to this function. And so to marry, as Bradley said, a couple must, in principle, be able to form a real bodily union, not just an emotional and spiritual union. Same-sex couples, he says, are unable to do this. The sexual acts that persons of the same sex perform at each other do not make them biologically one. Again, not all marriages will produce children. But as Jerry writes, the only thing that a couple can directly do regarding procreation is to perform the kind of act that will lead to procreation. In other words, that natural act of coitus absorbs the full meaning of the couple meeting in a biological union, even if the act of coitus does not bring forth a pregnancy. Now here, it may be enormously helpful to have the sense of sacraments, of small things containing larger meanings, a wafer to be ingested, legs bent in kneeling in veneration. Now, if we can indulge the license of supposititious reasoning, let's imagine someone found an IV solution, intravenous solution, decided on a whim to take a taste and said, now this would go beautifully on a salad. But even if it turned out to enhance the salad, what we find ourselves saying is, but that's not what it is. That's not what it's for. That's not the meaning of the thing. Now, if I could put earplugs on Jerry, I would take the next step in the style of Monty Python with a daring dentist who sedates a female patient and with her consent, enters her in the style of coitus because, as he claims, he gets a much better view of her molars that way. But no. Even with her consent, that is not what that kind of bodily joining is for. It's not meant for just anybody on any occasion. It is made available with the most restricted franchise settled on one who has a claim to intimacy for a purpose of love exceeding all other purposes. And so we understand that a rape is not just another assault, even if the male or female happen to be sterile. The joining of the body in coitus has a meaning and moral significance that remains there fixedly, even if no children are begotten. In fact, on a point that curiously flies past our recognition, the meaning of coitus in a natural understanding is so clear that it forms the ground of an unalienable right, a right that one may not be free to waive or alienate even for oneself. And that sense of the matter is curiously preserved when the law still forbids a woman to rent out her body for the pleasure or profit of strangers. Even her consent is not thought to face the wrong of coitus taking place in that way. The positioning of bodies may have the significance that stamps it as part of our natural language, as Thomas Reed would have, the signs understood by people everywhere. It's stop, come in on, come forward. It may be like that. It would be understood in all different countries, regardless of whether they had coitus would be understood for what it means in all countries, regardless of whether they had a presidential regime or a parliamentary regime. And that may lure people into saying that coitus is the most natural act, was there before politics and the law. But there, I think, we would push the argument to a stage too far and miss the completion of this argument in Aristotle. Aristotle lays it down in the politics that the polis, the political order, marked by the presence of the polis, he says, is prior in order of nature to the family. Prior. Now, this urbane man certainly understood that people were capable of having sex at those times when governments break down, or even before new governments were put in place. What he was telling us, rather, is that having sex is not the same as having a family, that a family depends on the commitments of law, and therefore depends on the polis, on the understanding within the community of what constitutes a family. Is it four persons? It could be a man with his animal. The late Ellen Bloom caught the sense of the matter quite sharply, and he wrote that it is only within the context of the law that man can really imagine that the offspring of his loins can people the world. The law that gives names to family and tries to ensure their integrity endures only as long as the regime of which it is a part. The bodily union of the couple that may produce children must be at the very center of the meaning of marriage, but it makes a profound difference that a couple were joined also in a commitment not to forego this union and the children it brings forth as it suits their convenience and their passing fancy. A marriage with no commitment would be no real marriage, and no commitment is more real, harder, than a legal commitment, especially a legal commitment hard to undo. But the point is, all of this is as much in accord with nature as is coitus. For as Aristotle showed us, the polis and the law are distinct emanations from human nature. Only one kind of creature knows what it means to make a promise, a commitment, to undertake an obligation and respect that commitment, even when it runs counter to his interests or inclinations. Only human beings are capable of making that kind of a commitment and that kind of a marriage. A union marked by the presence of a promise and commitment firmed up in law is a marriage that can be known only by human beings. And so, as Maggie Gallagher put it so movingly years ago, when she said, it is not free love, but the vow that is daring. To dare to pledge our whole selves to a single love is the most remarkable thing that most of us will ever do. The vow. But that is the point that leads into the deepest criticism that Jerry has leveled against conservative jurisprudence has been given to us. As he put it, since the 1980s, legal conservatives have wed their sound originalist instincts to a methodological doctrine of judicial restraint, a normative approach to how to decide a constitutional case that's allergic to critical moral reasoning. So conservatives who regard such reasoning as an allergen say that they scrupulously avoid relying upon these value judgments in justifying their decisions. And so, as Jerry Pitt put it, inoculating judicial interpretation of the Constitution against inflection by judges' value judgments, that has become for many conservatives the overriding desideratum of constitutional adjudication. Every move beyond the text of the Constitution, every appeal to moral reasoning was regarded simply as an appeal to one's own personal likes or dislikes. And so he said, Supreme Court nominees are regularly heard to insist that I would never dream of imposing my morality on the law. So Bradley has shown that on one major issue after another, the conservatives have prided themselves on steering around the questions of moral substance at the heart of the cases. As Jerry has developed this critique, he's shown that conservative jurisprudence, in its persisting aversion to moral reasoning, has brought us to the point where it cannot give an account any longer of the nature of that being, that human person, who can be regarded in the clearest sense as the bearer of rights. They can't do that. Leo XIII, with his usual common sense, saw the matter the way the American founders saw it, with that singular creatures who could give and understand reasons over matters of right and wrong. And so in his encyclical on human liberty, 1886, he pointed out the human beings are the only creatures who can deliberate over whether they are directing their liberty to ends rightful or wrongful. They began, in other words, with an imminent awareness of the distinction between liberty and license, whether they're using their freedom for rightful ends or abusing that freedom in pursuing the base ends. Cows and horses could not impart a moral purpose to property or inanimate manner. Only creatures of reason, moral agents, could impart those moral ends, and only those rational agents could become the bearers then of property rights or any other set of rights that could be misused. But as Jerry recognized, that understanding would have set Leo XIII radically at odds with Justice Anthony Kennedy and the elevation of autonomy as the guarantor of rights that would need no moral justification or be open to any serious moral challenge. For Leo XIII, autonomy simply meant that individuals were in control of their own acts, not governed by forces outside their control, and so they could be held responsible for their own acts. But for Justice Kennedy, as Professor Brandley pointed out, the assertion of autonomy was enough in itself to establish a deep right to kill unborn children in abortion, engage in the homosexual life, and have that mode of sex elevated to nothing less than the grounds of marriage. Jerry recalled in this vein Justice Kennedy in the Lawrence versus Texas invoking the mystery passage in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, with Kennedy making this point, that persons in a homosexual relationship may seek autonomy for the purpose of marriage and family relationships just as heterosexual persons do, and that homosexuals have the same constitutional liberty interest in this autonomy as do heterosexuals. In other words, to deny the rightness of the choice for same-sex marriage, is to deny the autonomy or the moral dignity of the man, the person who's making the choice. But as Jerry pointed out, very few people enter marriage for the purpose of exercising freedom or autonomy. Autonomy, he said, is about moral independence, a connection of not being enthralled to the desires or wishes, or being governed by forces outside our control. It's the existential condition of our choices. It's our competence to make choices. So what we have here is a real moral inversion. Autonomy is the ground on which we assign to people the responsibility for their own acts, for the choice they make. But for Kennedy, autonomy becomes an argument stopper. It was the condition that insulated any person from the need to offer any justification, to show that he indeed used his freedom to pursue rightful rather than debased ends. But as then we trace this things back, on what ground is this homosexual person, as described here, on what ground is this homosexual person, or any person, the bearer of rights? That is, if the mark of dignity was that one was emancipated from any need to give a moral account of oneself, from an obligation to show that one was using one's freedom for ends rightful rather than wrongful, what is the ground on which such a being, constituted in that way, claims to be the bearer of something we call rights? And here is where I think Jerry has taken things to ground zero in the collapse of conservative jurisprudence. The matter could be approached indirectly by asking, just who are those beings who may rightly claim the protection of the law for their lives, their property, their freedom? And as Jerry notes, Justice Blackmun conceded in Roe versus Wade that the fetus could be counted as a person. If a fetus could be counted as a person, then the case for right to abortion, of course, collapses. For the fetus's right to life would then be guaranteed specifically by the 14th Amendment. Blackmun would search the text of the Constitution And he found that the persons mentioned, there were people who were being extradited, fleeing persecution or slavery, being qualified for voting. In other words, included with high powers of influence. They had to be postnatal. And Teresa went over the same kinds of things earlier. A child may not be fleeing prosecution or applying for citizenship, yet he wouldn't cease to be a person or a human being. And as Bradley put it, stipulations about what some persons may or may not do imply nothing about when persons begin. Potter Stewart, with his usual stylish emptiness, asserted that the 14th Amendment defines person as somebody who's born, to which Jerry said, it does no such thing. Where does it say that in the text? Where does the text offer gradations on what counts as a human being subject to the protections of the law? And as Jerry remarked with chilling aptness, the Constitution does not define person in any words at all. In any words at all. What is engaged here, as he said, in an important phrase, what he said here is that, what's engaged here is a moral reality, namely those who are truly human persons. So the disgrace for conservative jurisprudence is that Justice Scalia and other conservatives have simply fallen into the mindset of Justice Blackmun. So with a textualism quite blinded, they read the Constitution as protecting only postnatal life. Now, all of this has sprung from a positivism that casts a warning against things not set down in the text, or reading the text in the light of moral reasoning. A jurisprudence has taken its pride in persistently steering away from the questions of moral substance because they are not thought to fall within the job description of judges. And now we found that full display of that emptiness showing itself in the most dramatic place in the Dobbs decision in overturning Roe. Justice Blackmun had it quite right. If the unborn child counted as a human person, it would be protected under the 14th Amendment. And if the court in Dobbs had been clear on that point, the 14th Amendment would have kicked in with even more force now. For with the matter of abortion returned to the political arena in the states, the so-called blue states now would be withholding the protections of life from a whole class of human beings within their jurisdiction. But the court could not bring itself to that point. For Justice Kavanaugh was continuing to insist that the Constitution was utterly neutral on this matter, that the human standing of the offspring in the womb was still a matter of belief, as he put it. He said, some people, lifers actually believe the fetus is human, as though we don't have a body of embryology going back 70 now, I was told today, 100, over 100 years, to establish that that nascent being has never been anything other than human from its first moments, and as though the deep principles of the Constitution contained no principles that could call into question a license to destroy innocent human life without the need even to render a justification. Nothing in the deep principles would carry any meaning of that kind. In order to foreclose the bearing of the 14th Amendment here, the conservative majority had to hold back from pronouncing the objective truth that the science of embryology has been given us for 100 years, that nascent life in the womb has been nothing other than human from its first moments. Justice Alito brought us to the edge, the marvelous part of his opinion. If the child in the womb could be protected at the point of viability, it could be protected before viability, because it was, after all, the same entity, the same human being. He managed to show, in one of his most critical moves, that there is no principled ground for treating that offspring of the womb as anything other than a human. No principled ground that would not apply to many people walking about well outside the womb. But he held back from drawing the conclusion that emerges from his argument. With that kind of lingering conservative reluctance to pronounce a moral truth that would settle the matter, he sort of followed the playbook and held back. But Jerry and I think he left things in a condition in which a Congress And yet even a single federal judge could take the next move, draw that conclusion, recognize the human standing of the child in the womb, and bring that child now under the protections of the 14th Amendment. But it could be that conservative judges are going to be very, very cautious in doing that, and it may fall to Sam Alito himself to make that move. But in the meantime, the dramatic truth is that Jerry uncovers for us is that a cluster of conservative justices with degrees from the most prestigious university cannot give an account of that central point under the American Constitution, just who are those creatures who are the bearers of rights. What is most embarrassing here is that this is not a question that perplexed or confounded the best minds of the American founders, or even common people at the time. You know, as James Wilson said, the Constitution was not brought forth to invent new rights, but to secure and enlarge those rights that flow to us by nature. Those were those so natural and unalienable rights that were pronounced in the Declaration of Independence. To secure those rights was the very purpose that called into existence this government. And as the Declaration said, a government lost its legitimate standing when it proved destructive of those ends, when it no longer secured those natural rights. But the claim to natural rights makes no sense at all, unless we're clear from the beginning, just who are the creatures or beings who bore those rights? We had to be able to explain that. Well, that's the understanding ground at the time. No man was by nature the ruler of other men in the way that God was by nature the ruler of men, and men were by nature the ruler of horses and dogs. Nothing was plainer to Americans of that age, to common people, as well as the leading minds. There was no baffling mystery here to raise a problem for the jurists. And if we knew who those creatures were, who were the bearers of rights, when did those rights begin? For James Wilson, the answer was not clouded in mystery. When did they begin? They begin as soon as we begin to be, which is why he said, in the contemplation of the law, life begins when the infant is first able to stir in the womb. By the law, life is protected not only from immediate destruction, but from every degree of actual violence, and in some cases, from every degree of danger. And so, that founding generation suffered no paralyzing doubts about the nature of that being who was the bearer of rights or of the moral ground of those rights. The contrast with the dual mind of conservative justice could not be sharper. And what it reveals again is what Jerry caught so rightly as the allergy to moral reasoning that took hold among conservatives in the 1980s. The anchoring moral truths of the Constitution became covered over with an overlay of theory. But that may simply confirm to us that the remedy now lies in recovery. Not the advent of something new, some new, ever more ingenious theory, but the recovery of what lawyers of the founding knew and what the American people can still understand when they hear it again. Those writings by Wilson, Hamilton, Marshall are still there to be read anew. And take that question I keep raising, where could we find a better assurance that the law we're preserving would be as comprehensible and compelling, as resonant with common sense in the next generation as it is in our own and as it will ever be? That's it. Now for a few jokes.
Someone else is going to provide this. Would anyone like to pose a question?
Jerry.
I ask this question quite often, apparently, especially after he's been this delightfully entertaining as today. But my question is whether now as your new co-director, which my understanding is I'm a kind of a co-adjutor, co-director, have a right of succession.
You are. You are the succession. You are the future of the Delphine.
I see. But I wonder, do I now I have a right to get a copy of your joke book?
You keep asking that.
I keep asking you.
But I don't know where the joke book is. It's like, you know, we're talking about this. Of course, Tom Stoppard and Jumpers, you know, comes up. Where do you find these things? It's where Tom Stoppard on the I'm the one who rejects existence of one who rejects existence of all truth, a man who not even can see that the train for Bristol leaves Paddington Station, even if you're there to see it, but he confirmed it only under the proviso that the same objective phenomena that are associated with the train for Bristol leaving Paddington Station could equally well be accounted for by Paddington Station leaving the train. And you realize these people are still with us. They walk around. And they want to vote and raise children. So, I don't know, these things are what was the line about? Stop with such great sorting. At a certain point, the moralist is going to sound like a crank haranguing the bus queue with the demented certitude of one possessed of privileged information. I like to be drawn to all those things, but you know, I used to say that my favorite epistemologist was Lou Costello, because one time Abbott comes up with a great idea, and Costello says, "That's an excellent thought. I was just going to think of it myself." I've got colleagues who can go for 2 weeks on that. And I used to say my second favorite anthropologist was Margaret Thatcher, who received during the Falkland War a peace proposal, and she says, "This is an idea of Peruvian origin." it's like the Pythagorean theorem. This is an idea. It's an idea about Greek triangles. So I don't know. I will have to codify this. Jerry needs no source. He is great on his feet. Not only is he so the writing so penetrating and so utterly clear, but he's the best company. Okay.
James Wilson Institute is in good hands. Please join me in thanking him.
This program has been brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. Thanks for listening.